Oke, selamat siang teman-teman yang ada di Indonesia. Bersama dengan saya, ini ada seorang tamu yang sangat istimewa dan ada acara yang istimewa. Maka kita akan mulai ya. Saya akan pakai bahasa Inggris sekarang. Well, okay, good morning, friends in Indonesia. We have a very special event, program. It is indeed unplanned, but it was because this morning I looked up my Facebook and found a very interesting info from our guest. She posted on Facebook about her dear teacher and mentor, Dr. James Cohn. And this day, today, is his 82nd anniversary of his birth. So I did not want to miss this day without acknowledging him, without honoring him, without remembering him. And here I am with one of his beloved students, his beloved assistants, when they met at Union Theological Seminary just across the street from here. I have the honor to live now in Morningside Heights, just across Union Theological Seminary. So welcome, Dr. Joanne Marie Terrell, and thank you for your kindness to share about the life and legacy of Dr. James Cohn, father of Black theology. And our topic today, I have from Black theology to Bali. Why Bali? Let me keep Bali for a minute and we will reveal the meaning of Bali for Dr. James Cohn later on. But Dr. Terrell, may I ask you one question? How did you know Dr. Cohn?
Well, I actually met him when I was an undergraduate student at Rollins College. I was a freshman, I think, maybe in my second semester at Rollins in 1977. And he was coming to the school to give a lecture. And I saw the poster advertising him coming to the school with his picture on it. And when I saw the poster, I had never heard of him. I had never seen him before. I didn't know what Black theology was. I just had an overwhelming mystical feeling that I was somehow connected to this man. And it was powerful. And I didn't know how to interpret what I was seeing. So I said to myself, well, maybe I'm going to marry him one day. And then I went to class, and my teacher, who was sponsoring Dr. Cohn's coming to campus, Dr. Arnold Wettstein, said, my friend James Cohn is coming to the campus. He's the father of Black liberation theology, and he's married to a wonderful woman. She's a lovely dancer. So I says, okay, so that's not what the vision meant. Maybe if I ever go to seminary, I'll go to Union and I'll study with him. I said that to myself, and I basically forgot that I had said that to myself. But when he came, I was impressed. I met him. I had a chance to meet him, and it was really, really wonderful. And I never forgot meeting Dr. Cohn. And a few years after I graduated from college, I moved to New York, and I was working at 475 Riverside Drive, also known as the God Box, the Interchurch Center, which was right across the street from Union Seminary. And so I was working for a famine relief organization. April of 1987, I went to hear the Whitney Young lecture at Columbia University. And the lecturer that year was Maya Angelou. And as she stood there, singing and offering her wisdom and her wit and her gift of word and poetry, I said to myself, you know, I can do what she is doing, but I have to do it from my own passions. I had majored in philosophy and religion and behavioral science in undergraduate school. And I'd always wanted to go to Union, so Union was right across the street from me. So the next day after that, I went and applied to Union. And I was accepted at Union and I was to start in the fall of 1987. And I started in the fall of 87 and I met Dr. Cohn again and he said he remembered me, but I don't think he really did. But he was super excited to meet me. By that time, his wife had passed away and she had been passed away for about 4 years. And Dr. Cohn had gone into a deep depression. But when I came, he kind of woke up because I think he recognized the opportunity here to mentor someone who had an intellectual capacity and interest in the work of theology, who had life experience that was very difficult and that needed his own influence, because what his gift was to help people to immerse in their own particularity. And I didn't know how to be immersed in the particularity of being a Black woman living in America in that time and day, because I was, like everyone else, influenced by the evangelical white theology that had nothing to do with the Black struggle for liberation or the Black struggle for somebodiness. It had nothing to do with that, and actually called for the denial of self, that actually called for the hermeneutics of sacrifice in relationship to the self. And so Dr. Cohn knew that a lot of work had to be undone in me in order for me to become the kind of theologian that I have become, a Black womanist, eclectic theologian with a wide cosmological perspective, but truly rooted in my particularity, truly rooted in the care and concern for Black people and for all people, for myself as well as all people. He taught me a very deep lesson that the love, which is the hallmark of Christianity, is not a self-denying love. It is an inclusive love. It is a self-inclusive love. Love is reflexive, and then it goes out. It redounds to oneself. And that revolutionized my concept of love, my whole way of being in the world, my whole way of regarding myself, my whole way of regarding myself in relationship to others, that I can love as freely as I want to, as long as I recognize the relationship between love and justice. And he helped me to see that more than anything. And at first, as I learned about the things in Black history and in Black experience that are shameful and hurtful, I grew angry, and that's what I was afraid of, because the Christianity I had been inculcated in told me that anger was not a part of a valid expression of a Christian. But truly what I learned is that the human being gets to experience all the range of emotions and can still be in relationship with God and can still be accountable to people and can still be accountable to a wide appreciation for the wonders of the universe. You can still experience anger. Just as scripture says, be angry and do not sin. The sin is when you're angry and you do not express it. So I had to learn how to transform the concept of sin. And in my first year of seminary, my first semester of my first year, I took systematic theology with Dr. Cohn. I wrote a paper called The Transformation of the Concept of Sin. And when he read it, he wrote on the back of it, I still have it somewhere in my office, but he wrote on the back of it a long note that said that it was the most brilliant thing he'd read in 20 years of teaching, that I could be anything I wanted to be in theology, in the academy, or in the church. But he wanted me to think about doing a PhD with him, and I said I would think about it. So I thought I would just think about it and give myself some time to think about it. But he was serious. So whereas I had intended to be a philosophical theologian, and in fact, my first advisor was Cornel West, Dr. Cone insisted that I was going to be a theologian. He insisted that that was who I was going to be. And in my first year, he put his mantle on me so that I couldn't go to any other disciplines, even though I was interested in church history, even though I was interested in biblical studies, and have maintained my love for those disciplines as a necessary part of the way I do theology. So I'm attentive to the things of history, and I'm attentive to the things, to the insights of biblical scholarship, but I am a theologian because I have something to say about who God is in this human experience of mine and people all over the world who suffer from the strictures of oppression. So, but I didn't know that until I met James Jones. I didn't know that until he met James Jones. And he saw in me what I didn't see in myself. So I'm deeply appreciative of who he is to me. He is as significant to me as my parents were. And I loved him, and he loved me. He gave of himself to me in a way that that made me know that he was always interested in what was best for me, what was best for my development as a theologian, what was best for my development as a contributing member of the theological guild. And I'm honored by the way that he honored me with my becoming his research assistant at the end of my Master of Divinity program. He called me like the day after graduation and told me he wanted me to be his research assistant. And I said, okay, I'll come back after the summer is over and we can start. He said, no, you have to start this summer because I need some work this summer done. So I stayed and I did the research on Malcolm X for the book Martin and Malcolm in America. That was my job, and you can see my credit for that on page Roman numeral 13.
yes, I still remember when I took Martin and Malcolm book, I read the acknowledgement and I found your name on it.
Yes.
That Dr. Cone thanked you for joining in the project, and this is profoundly beautiful for me, that Dr. Cone saw something in you, that you would be a theologian even though you also studied with the great Dr. Cornel West. Mm-hmm. I could not imagine how you felt studying with those great people, and also you studied with Professor Dolores Williams, that you acknowledge her as one of your great mentors. Mm-hmm. My question
also
is
with James Ford as my preaching teacher, and I had James Melvin Washington, who was a wonderful historian to teach me church history. And
all
the teachers at Union, such as Phyllis Tribble and Richard Norris, they were top-notch scholars who profoundly impacted my life and profoundly impacted my mentality and made me that much more committed to a true liberation, not only for myself, but for all people who are willing to listen and learn and grow through connecting our experiences together. So all those wonderful people, but Dr. Thompson was adamant that I was his student. Yes.
Yes. Now, that's exactly my question, Dr. Terrell. Why did you choose to be a theologian, and what's so interesting in theology so that you decided that this is, this will be my way?
Well, actually, it goes way back before I ever met Dr. Khan. I was living on the island when my father was in the Air Force, and we were not a church-going family, but I would go to chapel on the Air Force base where we lived, and one day I came home and I said to myself, I would like to tell Jesus that I want to be an agent for him. And so I'm going to baptize myself, because I didn't think my parents would let me be baptized.
Uh-huh.
So I baptized myself. And one day, after I had baptized myself, I found myself telling a lie to my mother. And according to my limited knowledge of what it meant to be a Christian,
Dr. Terrell, I could not hear you.
Can you hear me now?
Oh, yes. Perfect.
Yes. So I wrote a letter to the only person who I could call, who I thought I could call upon to answer the question, why did I tell this lie? I wrote Billy Graham a letter, and he wrote me back. I was
Billy
8 years
Graham.
Old. Yes. He wrote me back.
I could not hear you again, Dr. Trell.
It took a long time for the letter to come back from the mainland USA. But when it finally came, I was so excited, and I opened it. And I remember that it said something about original sin. And I remember thinking to myself, what he was saying can't be right. Now, and I threw his letter in the trash. But now I recognize then that nothing would ever capture my attention or be as important to me as theological questions. Even though I didn't have that language, of course, I knew that's what I wanted to do. I just didn't know how to name it.
Mm-hmm.
I knew that's what I wanted to be. So fast forward a few years, and we moved back to the States. And at age 15, my mother was murdered. And when she was murdered, I went to live with my aunt and uncle. And my uncle is a pastor of a revivalist church that my ancestors actually started along in 1914. And my aunt was a missionary, and it was very fundamentalist, and I had to participate in that worship and the service. There were wonderful things about that worship and service, including their capacity to ask the questions and including their love for the Bible, which helped me, because that's how I know what's in the Bible. A lot of people come to seminary and don't know what's in the Bible, but I knew what was in the Bible because of that experience. So that was a profound experience. But when I was 16, I began preaching. And when I was 19, I stopped preaching because I was in college and I realized I didn't have a strong enough base of knowledge. Again, because the theological questions were shaping up in my head as the most important questions to me. And so I started college with the intention of majoring in behavioral science because I wanted to be a social worker. But I took so many courses in philosophy and religion that the department notified me I could double major. So I double majored in philosophy and religion and behavioral science. But my real interest was in philosophy and religion. I graduated from college. Before I went to seminary, I waited a couple of years. And when I finally moved to New York to work for that famine relief organization, That's when I met Dr. Cohn again. And he even, I didn't know that you could break the discipline up into such categories or fields as the biblical field or the field of or simply study languages or simply study church history. I was thinking it was a holistic thing, and it can be that experience. You can and should have that experience of interdisciplinary studies. But I really focused in on theology because really I wanted to signify not just what I had experienced, because theology is not biography, even though biography is very important to doing the discipline of theology. Theology is the study of God. God is the subject of theology, and you have to say not just what your experience is, but who God has been to you through your experience. And that became the most important factor in my wanting to signify, well, who is God in all of this? Who is God for this orphaned child? Who is God for this lonely woman? Who is God for this woman who is separated from all of her family and all of her friends, and a woman who has intellectual capacity, but also a heart for loving people and loving the church and loving the cosmos and respecting the whole cosmos? How do you put all of that together in a coherent statement about who God is in all of this, or in a coherent thought system about who God is in all of this? And it became very apparent to me that would be my strength once I surrendered to the process of becoming a theologian.
Beautiful. And what is the image of God that you then understood? Probably you have some transformation of the image of God that you find through your journey.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's been a very interesting journey. Because like I said, in my early years, we were not raised in the church. So I didn't have a hard and fast image of God so much as my impressions, my very young, nascent impressions of who God was or what God was. We did have in our household some accoutrements of religion. We had a whatnot that had a stand that had a picture, a three-dimensional depiction of the crucifixion. But I didn't really understand what that meant. When you looked at it one way, you saw Jesus suffering on the cross. You looked at it another way, you saw Jesus ascending into heaven. And I really thought that one picture was Jesus suffering and the other one was God just above the clouds. But I didn't ask anybody what it meant. I just kind of, those were the first physical images of the divine that I had imbibed without much explanation for them. But it wasn't what I really felt in my heart. I didn't connect with the suffering, and I didn't, the ascending Jesus, who I thought was God, didn't really strike me as connected to me. So I didn't really have language for what I was experiencing, because I was experiencing mystical things. I was a very mystical young child. I was experiencing visions, and I was experiencing this overwhelming feeling of love and connectivity to the earth and the environment and all the beauty of earth. I felt transcendently connected to those things. So I didn't have language for what I was experiencing. I had a kind of very young, but very wise mind. So I became like the sage in my family, even though I was the youngest of seven children. And people kind of looked to me for that kind of bearing, to have that kind of bearing. it's a strange thing. So I just continue to harbor those feelings without having a real way of talking about them. Not until I went to college and I began to study world religions. And as I studied world religions, I connected profoundly with Taoism and Hinduism and Buddhism. And the Vedic traditions were very appealing to me because they were giving me language for what I had experienced, even though the evangelical God talk was of a white male, old, barefooted, and wear white robes like the God in
sitting on the throne on the cloud.
Yes, the God in the color purple that Seeley described at first. Even though that was the language I had, it wasn't really my experience of God. And my experience of the divine really was described better in the other texts. But there was something about the biblical text that made me want to engage with people, and not just with myself, and not just with be preoccupied with my own enlightenment or my own self-transformation. There was something about the biblical text that demanded justice in a way that other texts did more subtly. There was something about the biblical text that was really powerful. Something about the person of Jesus that was really powerful and that kept me in a Christian groove. Even though I recognize the role of Christianity in the history of religions and the unsuitability of even calling some of what in the name of Christianity Christian. It took James Cone to teach me that, to open my mind and to help me to break away from the embedded theologies that I didn't even know were there, because some of it you just receive by osmosis from society. For we're all in America, we're all compelled to participate in Christian holidays. We're all compelled to participate in Christian ideations of what it means to be religious, because Christianity forms the basis of our civil religion. But that doesn't mean that the other religions have nothing to say or nothing to teach us about who and what God is. And so I kept my mind open. And even though the education at Union was definitely profoundly Christian, I still kept my mind open and I kept my heart open to the things I knew were valid in the expressions of other traditions. And because I had witnessed it in myself, I had understood it for myself, even though I didn't have language for it when I was very, very young, and very, very mystical. So.
Yeah, friends, Dr. Terrell wrote a book, Power in the Blood, but let me read from the acknowledgments in which Dr. Terrell says something about her mentor. She wrote, "My mentor, Dr. James H. Cone, taught me some hard lessons. Among the hardest were developing discipline as a scholar and learning to be ever more honest with myself as a human. Dr. Cone has certainly been a demanding academic advisor, but has been an equally gracious friend." Dr. Terrell, when you recall these words, why did you put these words on your acknowledgments?
Well, So when we think about a mentor and mentee relationship, it's not always easy to receive instruction.
It's not
an easy thing to allow yourself to be transformed by someone else's thought pattern. Embedded theologies are called that because they're hard to remove, but they had to be removed in order to be replaced with a theology that was truly liberative for me, not just as a Black person, but as a Black woman. And not just as a Black woman, but as a person who desires connectivity with the whole world. You know, so if you have to be free in order to do that, and you have to be you have to speak truth to yourself. Who are you? What is my purpose? Who am I? What is my purpose? What do I need to let go of in order to become? Well, those are hard things to do. Those are hard lessons to learn. How can I be honest with myself? Who am I in relationship to God? Am I moralistic? How do I let go of that tendency that has been inculcated in me through evangelical religion? Am I judgmental? Am I hurtful to people on the basis of my religion? Do I do violence in the name of my religion?
Mm-hmm.
Other belief systems? Certainly not physical violence, but do I do violence to other people's belief systems by the way I believe, by the way that I think, and by the way I regard people? And those are hard things to admit to oneself and hard to let go because they provide some measure of certainty in the world. But I learned that if you have certainty, you don't need faith. But if you have faith, it doesn't exist alongside certainty. Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Faith and uncertainty go hand in hand. You know, faith is not rigid. It can't be, and it can't be rigid and please God. I think that is the problem of most religions. When they become rigid, they become displeasing to God and they become displeasing to their neighbor. And I don't know how often people can become displeasing to themselves and not change. And so the change was necessary in me because I didn't want to be judgmental because of embedded theologies against LGBTQI persons. I didn't want to be that person. I didn't want to be judgmental against people who are embroiled in substance abuse. I didn't want to be judgmental. Once you don't have those things to hold on to, you feel a bit like rudderless. And then, that's the synonym for being free. The synonym for being free, and I like being free. I like being free to love whoever I will, you know. And I like others being free to love whoever they will. And I think that when you are actually free, you have a capacity to love more and more. I think that the smaller the circle of those you love, the smaller the person. You know? So it's certainly important to love oneself, but it's important to broaden the circle and to draw it wide and to love the whole world as scriptures say God does. So I've been changed by Dr. Cohn to recognize my narrowness. And that was a hard thing to do. But at the same time, he was gracious to me as a friend because he wanted the very best for me. If you know what a friend is, a friend is one who wants the best for the other person, whatever that means. And he wanted the best for me. And he gave me of himself in some profound ways. He called someone, told them to give me a job at a church because he knew I wasn't able to find one on my own. He called me to his house one summer and he asked me to he told me that they were painting his apartment and that he wanted me to remove the books from his shelves and put them back on. But he wanted me to put them back on in some kind of recognizable order. But he didn't trust anybody to do this. So I'm doing this day after day, watching Dr. Cohn in his living room, reading books for 8 hours a day. That was his habit, was to read for 8 hours a day. In fact, he told his mother he wouldn't come to visit her unless he could read his 8 hours, and then she could talk to him. So, but that was his habit. While I was working, he was reading, and I was all resentful and everything. But after that exercise was over, I realized that I had an encyclopedic knowledge of what was available in Black theology and Black literature and some world theologies as well. I still retain that to this day. It was kind of like, you know, the Karate Kid, Mr. Miyagi, wax on, wax off, and you don't know the purpose of the repetitive exercise. But just the titles of books can jog your thinking in such a way that you become an organic thinker. And that's what Dr. Cohn was doing for me. That was part of him giving himself to me in that profound way, giving the best of himself to me in that profound way. And so many lessons like that, that I'm only now coming to realize were for my benefit. I didn't always experience what he gave me as love, but I recognize it as love now.
So what is the greatest impact of Dr. James Cohn as the father of Black theology on you, personally, spiritually, and academically?
Personally, I would say that the greatest impact that he had on me was that I became aware that I was lovable, that I had somebody-ness.
Mm-hmm.
In my paper, The Transformation of Concept of Sin, there was a line that I remember that I had written. I think that was probably the poignant part of the paper. It was after my mother died, and I was living with my aunt and uncles, and I moved out when I was 19, and I felt lonely, unlovable, and sad. That was the phrase in the paper that I remember. And I think that was the poignant part for Dr. Cohn. And he wanted to make sure that I didn't feel any of those things, that I didn't feel unlovable, and that I didn't feel sad. And the way he addressed that was by helping me to see my purpose in life, but also helping me to see my value as a, not only as a thinker, but as a wonderful person, as a beautiful woman, as a woman beloved by God. I mean, and I think when you know that you are loved, you can do anything. If that becomes the truth from which you cannot fall, you can do anything. And that's so no matter what things look like, I know I'm lovable. That's what Dr. King did. That's the power of that personal gift. Professionally, like I say, he called someone and told them to give me a job at the church when I needed to have an internship, and he knew I wouldn't be able to find one because my church was rather uncooperative in helping us find places to do our internship. He named me his research assistant, his third in the succession of research assistants. I was the first woman and the third person to be his assistant. He gave me particular jobs and special things to do, like go and interview famous scholars such as John Henry Clark and David Garrow. He let me do the Malcolm research, and I met Betty Shabazz through him. I was blown away by her presence. And then one day while I was in the midst of writing my dissertation, he called me and he told me they need someone at Chicago Theological Seminary as a faculty leave replacement. Can I give them your name? And I said, yes. So he gave them my name. I came out to Chicago 1 week, and the next week I had a job. And I've been here for 25 years now. So that's pretty cool. So professionally, he was there. And in this kind of mystical way, he let me know that I would be as beloved and effective with my students as he was, because I dreamt of him one night. And when we were living in New York, it was our custom to walk down Broadway and talk theology. And one day he said to me, well, I dreamt of him that night. And he said to me in that dream, I said to him, Dr. Cone, see how even your shadow influences me and so many people. And he said, Joanne, the same thing happens to you with respect to your students. So he let me know that I had a gift to give as a teacher, that I was a teacher. He told me I was a teacher, in fact. He told me that in real time, that I was a teacher. And I resisted that for a time because I had an idea that, you know, I could be useful in the church too. So I was trying to straddle both. And I did for many years straddle the church and the academy. I thought I was being really, really faithful. But before he died, one of our last conversations, he told me, Joanne, I sent you to the academy to save you from the church. Because I know how sexist they can be. Mm-hmm. So professionally, he was just insightful, amazing. Even after I became a professor at Chicago Theological Seminary, he supported everything I did. I worked for the church as the academic dean of the Leadership Training Institute of the Midwest Episcopal District, and he came and talked to the Midwest Episcopal District at my request. So he was always very supportive of everything that I did, and he taught me so very much about even the proper relationship to things, you know? That things are not something you need to grab and grasp after. But, you know, and that's why I proudly say almost everything I own, someone gave it to me. You know, I proudly say that. Because,
yeah.
Almost because I have, and I'm free-hearted too. And he gave me a sense of how to have a proper relationship with things, and to find value in people and fun in things. So, and you said personally, professionally, and how else?
Spiritually.
Spiritually. And spiritually, well, there's just been no one before or since with whom I connected on a spiritual level the way that I did with Dr. Cone. Honestly, I could dream of him one night and he would call me the next day, or he would be heavy on my mind and then he would call me and ask me to do something important and huge. Like when he called me just before he died and asked me to sing at his funeral. And that was important because Dr. Cone loved the arts. But he also recognized, you know, the capacity of unenlightened folks to want to be entertained rather than taught. So he discouraged me when I was a student from singing all the time. he said, if you have to sing, sing the show. Because he wanted people to take me seriously as a scholar. But, I had to retake my claim to be an artist after I became a theologian.
Yes. Earlier today, you wrote to me that Dr. Cone loved all the gifts, the singing, the poetry, the visual arts, the facility with language. Mm-hmm. I imagine that he is a whole person. Like, he loved everything, not only academic. He's excelled in academic life, but also in art,
he loved the arts, and that's also very apparent in all of his books that are always prefaced by poems by Black poets. He loved Amiri Baraka especially, and he loved Margaret Burroughs, and loved Nikki Giovanni and all of the Black artists. He loved music. In fact, one of the times that I was working at his house, he asked me to help him shift his musical acumen to a more contemporary palette. So I did. I helped him with that. Well, some of the things I did, I didn't want to do, but I ended up doing them out of love and out of respect for him. But realizing, that's a good exercise for me too, because as I grow older now, I have a young daughter, and she keeps me enlightened about what I should be listening to. he taught me a lot surreptitiously.
Yes.
And also gave me a kind of permission to explore the range of my creativity.
Yes.
He was so affirming of my writing gifts that he mentioned me in the same conversation with Toni Morrison and Maya Angelou and people like that, and like, oh, so you can write. You can write creatively too. You can write theology, but you can write creatively too. So I have a fond expectation that once I retire from teaching seminary, I can write and become a contributing author in the literary world. So I have confidence because he had that kind of confidence in me.
Definitely. Like you mentioned also, you took the path that Dr. Cone did not do when he was still alive with us. Like you took the Black theology, your tradition, to also include other world religions and other world traditions in your work. Could you say more about that, why you chose that?
Because it was my truth. Now his truth was that he grew up in the American South, where racism was particularly virulent and violent, and lynching was common. I'm significantly younger than Dr. Cone, but and my experience of racism was a bit more institutional, so I was glad to that I was not bound to the evangelical template that a lot of scholars in his era and before him had to work through. He was a neo-Orthodox theologian in the traditional part, and also embraced some of the tenets of liberalism as well, in order to craft his own Black liberation theology. And Black liberation theology is part of my template, but as I have grown in life, I have recognized my own need to express my native spirituality, the spirituality that I had before I had words. The relationship I had with God before I even understood what God is. Not that I completely understand it, but. And also my connection to the rest of the world. I've traveled quite a bit since becoming a professor, before and since becoming a professor. Traveled quite a bit. And everywhere I've gone, I've found people very open to me, very loving to me, very kind to me, because I'm an open and loving and kind person, no matter their religion. And so I figured that they had something to teach me, not only through their way of being in the world, but also through their scriptures. And so I didn't mind opening the scriptures. I'm not afraid of opening other scriptures. I'm not afraid of learning more and more about God. And I don't think Dr. Cone was afraid. I think he was just devoted to the cause of Black liberation. And I am certainly devoted to the cause of Black liberation. And I'm also devoted to the survival of Black folk and the wholeness of an entire people, male and female. But I recognize, and Dr. Cone recognized too, which is why he was a founding member of the Ecumenical Association of Third World Theologians. I recognize that other people have something to say, something profound to say about God. Theology is God talk, it's not God talking. It's people talking about God. And what are they saying about God? What are they signifying through their cultural lens? What are they signifying through their religious habits? What are they signifying about God? And I want to know, because I think knowing more about God is better than knowing less about God. And I think that other people have something to teach me, not just by their scriptures and not just by their religious habits, but also by their visage, the way they look. They're the image of God too. What can I see of God in your face? What can I know about God by your way of being? So I was always open-minded about that, and I'm unafraid now, completely unafraid of offending God, because I really personally don't think God cares much about how we frame God. What God cares more about is how we regard each other. I think that's how we regard each other. That's the God we can know. That's the God we can see. How do we see each other? How do we see each other rightly? How do we see each other lovingly and as gifts to each other? And it's so hard because white supremacy has everybody doubting their beauty, has everybody doubting their intellect, has everybody doubting their capacity to say valuable things and be a harbinger of beauty.
Yes. And rightness. Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Dr. Terrell, with the uprising of Black Lives Matter, we know that racism is still around us. We can find racism everywhere, and I may add, even in my country. But Dr. Cone, the father of Black theology, has left us in 2018. So if you imagine, if Dr. Cone were still with us, what would he still have to say for the reality of racism and racial injustice?
Well, I think that he would personally be still on fire decrying the racism that can allow that allows us to pass without comment the killing of Black folk by police and extra vigilante groups. What kind of faith do we have that says that that's all right? I think he would be, but Dr. Cone is still with us in a profound way. You know, he's still with us in the 50 or more students that he mentored.
Yes.
I'm like number 25 or something like that. But there are 50 PhDs that have Dr. Cone's name, and I've graduated a few students myself with PhDs, and they have too. So Dr. Cone is still very much alive in that sense. But if he were physically with us, you know, he might not be able to actually do the physical activism, but he can do. He would do the academic activism. That's what I've been doing. I've been doing academic activism for 25 years at Chicago Theological Seminary, laying the academic foundation for the truth that sets people free. So, thank you very much, Alan.
Yeah. Right, yeah. And reading all his works again, I think that Dr. Cone does not leave us. His voice is still with us, and his voice is still strong, speaking loudly and on fire about what is happening in the world today. And I think this can be also inspiration for people around the world who also deal and struggle with the issues of injustice and racial problems in their...
And I think it is a sin and a shame that degrees of brownness is a metric by which human worth is measured. That's horrible. That's horrible. I think it's a sin and a shame that people are separated by color, and declared worthless on the basis of proximity to blackness. I think that's sad. I think it's sad that people want to bleach their skin. I think it's sad that people don't regard themselves as made in the image of God just as they are, or regard others in the same way. I think it's sad that people don't see beauty in all that God creates. I mean, that's part of what I say on my podcast.
Yeah. And many times also we witness that the violence on black and brown people is sanctioned by the state.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And sanctioned by our religions, too.
Yes.
Sadly, I am a Christian minister who is also a senpai in Vajrayana and Zen traditions of Buddhism. But sadly, Christianity has a horrible record of brutal imperialism and ideological imperialism. And Buddhism has a taint on it in the way in which Buddhist monks treat people from Bangladesh living in Myanmar. That's horrible. That's horrible. And it has to do with degrees of brownness. It has to do with the insidiousness of racism. I think it's sad when that we use our religion for whatever we want to use it for. Instead of the good things that they actually harbor within them.
And sometimes with the silence of religious people, that also perpetuates the violence over the black and brown skinned people.
Yes, it does. It does. The silence of people perpetuates violence. And I'm reminded of a verse in James that says, "You have not because you ask not." We don't have peace because we don't ask for it. We don't have justice because we don't ask for it. Not consistently enough. And that's what Jane Cone offered us, was a consistent voice crying out for somebody-ness, for all people really, but for black people particularly, because the anti-blackness of racism is a deep and meaningful trope in almost every nation. Almost every nation.
Yes, yes. And so I also believe that we still need to listen to Dr. Cone's voice today, wherever we are. Dr. Terrell, let's move to the lighter side of Dr. Cone, and let's say something about Bali, because I heard from my roommate here that Dr. Cone knew Bali pretty well, and he went to Bali for, I don't know how many times he went to Bali. What did Dr. Cone do in Bali?
Yeah, I drove him to the airport a few times as he was leaving the country for Bali. Yes, I did. He'd go to Bali in order to write, especially when he had long sabbaticals that were a year or more. he would go and spend time there, and he would come back and tell me about his trips there. And he said that the people of Bali were so kind to him, and they would give him the peace that he needed, and the natural surroundings were so beautiful. And he just loved being there. He loved being there. So I have an intention of going to Bali someday myself.
Yes, 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 yes. Please, please do. If you go to Bali, as I mentioned to you, you have friends, you have sisters, you have brothers.